What's going on, y'all? You are listening to the Chain Reaction Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremiah Mitchell, joined once again by our lovely co-host, Jeremiah Harding. What's up, man? How's it going?
That's reasonable. Oh, just a preface for the audience. I fucked up my eye somehow in a way that I don't actually still know. So I'm going to be looking away from the lights that are in the room to give my face that proper pale fucking lighting that people crave so much. But I'll be looking down and away from those lights. So if it looks like I've got anime eyes, that's why. Don't worry, I'm not going to convert into a cartoon before your eyes.
I don't think anyone's afraid of that, but it would be quite interesting.
It would be interesting, but it would also, like, remove the dimensions of my personality, you know? It would probably exaggerate some others. It wouldn't be pleasant.
Okay, well, fine. You don't have to do that then. So,
I'll reschedule, you know.
Okay.
But we'll find a better time.
Yeah, if you can figure out how to make that happen next week, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, do you want to give a 30-second update on Nazi furries from 2 weeks ago?
Okay. There's a site for us terrible Nazi furries at this point that got built up by Bloomier Wolf on Twitter. And he's also that over there as well. It's called furryspeech.com, and it's dedicated to saying what we would have said elsewhere if the SJWs hadn't blacklisted us there. It's still weird to me that I'm included in that. I think Stefan Molyneux was actually removed from the list of Nazi furries. But for some reason,
it's because he's so bald. Like, you know,
yeah,
you with all your hair makes you look like you might always be wearing some sort of bad furry costume.
Yeah, right. Like it's a natural fursuit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were born to be a Nazi furry. It's a shame, that you have that birthmark in the shape of a swastika, though.
That's
too bad.
Definitely. You know, it's sort of it's sort of interesting because I've got the opposite facial patterns of Hitler. He's got like the little it in the middle, and I've got
it's
thing
missing.
On the side.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not missing, but you just have a little more on the edges there. Yeah, I didn't notice that. You are the anti-Hitler.
Yeah, I got the hair. I'm advocating for, you know, peace and anarchy rather than ethnostatism. Fucking. Well, I'm advocating for violence that leads to peace, which, you know, I think that is a subject for another time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's some people have this definition of violence. I think Mark Passio it started with, or at least he might be the big originator. Yeah, I get it. I know what that is. But he talked about how his definition of violence is that defensive force is not violence, and violence is only aggression. So
yeah,
you could frame it like that. Yeah, I agree. I mean, but we spent a lot of time as anarchists trying to clarify word meanings and kind of changing and shifting word meanings and getting in all these very nuanced discussions about what we mean when we say X. So it's perfectly reasonable for in the context of particular conversations to specifically define violence as one thing, and then it's at least understood by both parties. I don't necessarily agree with that definition, but I don't know. Anything, I'm peeking out my audio here, so I'm going through the settings trying to change it. I appreciate just trying to think about that stuff a little.
I know, it's just, it seems like a pussy's way out. It's like, I'm not going to be violent. Oh, but you just shot that man. Oh, but that wasn't violent.
I would never be violent. Yeah, there's a lot about Passio that I'm not quite sure on. Obviously, I have a special place in my house for, my heart, not my house. Maybe my house, but perhaps not. For anyone who doesn't advocate for aggression, Like, I'm like, you know, don't like that, but at least you don't support violence against me. That's a step in the right direction.
Well, unless it's not violence.
Right. The initiation of force.
But I thought you initiated force. So that thing where I cut off your arm, that's totally chill.
Yeah.
I just, it just bothered. I've sort of promised somebody, well, I've promised them without the spit this time, that I'll be doing a DTube video on that subject, on sort of rebutting the entire Mark Passio lecture thing that everybody posts the YouTube link to, where they're like,
he has a bunch of them.
Violence.
Oh, that one in particular?
One speech he gave at the hotel thing, and it's like what everybody posts. And so I'm going to respond to that, because I think that that's pretty much all I need to respond to. Because honestly, if his entire framework is based on that particular thing, and I can disprove that particular thing, then I've sort of, like, you know, Boston Tea Partied his cargo cult, and that would make me smile.
I don't think his entire framework is that simple, though, is it? I've only watched a little bit.
Well, I mean, that's the basis for a lot of it, you know?
Okay.
That's the reason why he calls certain things aspects of natural law, because they aren't, quote, violent, even though they very clearly are, to, like, bear scrutiny. It's like, right. Oh, but it's not violence.
Depending upon how you define violence.
I mean, I don't like that, because if you say that violence is somehow, like, just the things you don't like that are forceful, you know, then that could basically mean that people could finagle their way out of being nonviolent, even though they do a lot of very violent things by conventional understanding.
Yeah,
and that's not going to do anything to advance anarchy, because people are going to see violent people saying they're not being violent, and they'll just think we're fucking insane.
I agree. I think we should adhere to whatever the sort of standard generally understood definitions of words are, in as much as we can, to communicate right. The message, for sure.
You violate my boundaries, I'm going to violate the fuck out of you.
Yeah. I'm probably not, but I will request that you stop, and then we'll go from there.
Well, I'm saying violate as in violence.
If they accidentally trespass,
I don't really call that a violation. If I don't have a sign and they they're going for a jog and a drop of their sweat lands on like the right centimeter on my property line, that's not violation. But if they come on my property with a gun and say I'm not leaving, then that's a violation, and I'm probably gonna do something violent to them.
Yeah, even with that, I've been punched and shoved and the like, and I've just asked people to stop.
As a response, you have a religion that says that it's much better to turn the other cheek and to not let them control you by making you more violent than God would want you to be. So there is a little bit of an ideology there, and it's a respectable one.
Yeah,
but
prioritize
it is the ideology.
Prioritize love. But in all those cases, let me just be clear, I was willing to throw down if necessary.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's just try to choose
minimal
necessary. Well,
if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one.
Peace generally leads to more peace, depending on the circumstances. In many human relationships, most people, when actually confronted with the opportunity, aren't that interested in having violence done to them and doing violence to others that don't want it. So sometimes just stopping and pausing and inviting people to think through whether or not they would like to continue down this path, it results in them stopping. No, I guess I'm not that interested in it. It's having just a decent human interaction is better. Also, we didn't say this. I don't know what's wrong, you guys. I think I keep updating this program and then it keeps changing settings around on me, so I keep having audio issues. That way you need to adjust right before the show. But we are going to have Shane Radliff on today to talk about prepping and survival as a general topic. I don't know specifically what we're going to talk about. I'm just trusting Harding has got a list of questions ready. Make my day easy.
Well, he's pretty much going to say what he said on Moment of Rage, only more concise. Because he came onto my program 2 weeks ago, and we discussed survival and prepping, generally what to do. And he also discussed, I think it's called the Maranea Project, because he's involved in a seasteading project that's new and designed for sustainability and shit. And it's also not depending on, you know, government treaties to thrive. So it's, you know, it's he has a lot of interesting things to discuss. And I'm basically going to let him have at it, because the framework on my show was a little bit more inquisitive directly, but a lot of the questions were answered there. So if anybody's interested in a more in-depth discussion that isn't a guest spot on this podcast, then they can go check that out. It's about an hour-long show done. Oh, actually, it might have been 3 weeks ago. It was something.
I'll link to it on the show notes page at timetofree.us. You can just search for probably 37, and that'll put you right to the episode page, and then you can click the links if you want to listen to the show. So remember to send me that after. Is he ready?
Yeah, no problem.
It's technically our time.
Yeah, he's ready.
All right, you want to bring him on?
And by the way, for the listener's benefit, there was a scheduling conflict that was my fault. So he's been very gracious to massively move it up during the day. So thank you, Shane, if you're listening right now.
Yeah,
I'm
we
going
can't
to
remember.
Call him and we
you just go call him.
Yeah,
we can't remember what time the show starts anymore because we're dealing with different time zones and times are hard. And we keep changing it all the time because I have scheduling conflicts because once you get a kid, schedules just don't work out as well as you hope that they will.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, and I just have this weird, extreme, sudden need for cash because I'm possibly moving to New Jersey. So, like, there's a possibility that, any of these things could be canceled if I can get significantly high-paying work.
Right.
But, you know, I think adults have to get used to schedule changes, and it's, you know, really fortunate that we have somebody who was as even keeled about it as Shane was, which I think he's on now. So, thank you for showing up, massively early, Shane.
Not a problem. I appreciate the invitation.
So, I already sort of gave you an introduction. I think actually what would be most interesting to start with, because I, you know, we have an anarchist audience. I think the survival and prepping would be something interesting, definitely for this cast. But I think what would be most interesting is if you could give us a 5 to 6 minute rundown of the Maranea Project. I think that's what it was called.
Yeah. So unfortunately, as of now, there has been an update since the last time we talked, and the Maranea Project is on hold. Bob Llewellyn, the project manager, was, you know, funding all of that out of pocket, and after a year or so with, you know, limited growth, he decided to, you know, put the project on hold. It's not done, but it's on hold. But yeah, the Maranea Project is a seasteading venture that is slated, hopefully, to set out in the Quetzal Bank, which is in between the Bahamas, Cuba, and Florida. There in that kind of in that little triangle area, and the phase one was basically the idea was to get a barge or a flotel, and this is where the two projects. I'm sure you've heard of the Seasteading Institute. This is where the two plans kind of diverge. Maranea is going to be using, hopefully is going to be using already existing technology. Whereas the Seasteading Institute, they're coming up with all of this architecture, these really grand schemes from scratch. So, as far as simplicity, Maranea is, you know, worlds ahead, I would say, in that. So the phase one would basically be just a, it's, It's called a flotel, so it's a barge that's been repurposed to be a hotel. It's very luxurious, and the idea is to put that out in the water and, you know, start with that. And then at that point, we'd be able to, there'd be a lot of profit-making venture out there on the water, so outside investing wouldn't really be that big of an issue at that point, which also kind of differs from the Seasteading Institute, at least to some degree. So that's kind of the Marinilla project. It's a seasteading venture that, you know, hopefully will take place out in the Quezal Bank. I definitely recommend your listeners go look that up on a map. It's a very, very interesting area. But yeah, that'd kind of be a brief rundown of the Marinilla project.
Shane, what's the cost of something like that? I'm sure it's gotten to the point where they've figured out kind of basic costs, right? For the original just barge, hotel,
flotel. Right, yeah. Yeah, so the flotel, the phase one is $15 million. So okay, that's the,
not,
the
not
price.
Not bad.
No, it's, I mean, it's still a lot of money.
It's reasonable.
Sure,
yeah, a ton of cash, but yeah. It's reasonable.
Yeah, yeah, and if you look at some of the seasteading projects back in the 60s and 70s, they were spending hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars. So $15 million, that's realistic. That's really realistic compared to some other, prices I've seen in the past.
Yeah, was there a plan to do something similar to what the Seasteading Institute is trying to do by getting permission from local nation states to be able to float in particular areas and have this business?
No.
Okay.
No.
Cool.
So the Seasteading Institute, yeah, they have a hosting nation state, French Polynesia.
Yeah.
And the idea with the Marinilla project is to be in international waters, but still within the exclusive economic zone of a country. And they just real briefly, the exclusive economic zone is the area. I think it's like 237 miles off of the seafloor, the atolls, any sort of land, any sort of resources on the ocean floor. Within that 237 miles, nation states and countries already have claimed the exclusive economic rights to those. So if it's a floating village at sea, it's not utilizing any of that, and we aren't, you know, mining oil off of the ocean floor, then I guess, you know, hoping that governments will follow their own laws, then, you know, they have no prerogative to actually come out there and do anything about it. So
and
that's
not
the difference.
Create new ones.
yeah. So it's definitely different. There's not going to be any asking for permission from governments.
I like that.
So that's the main difference, and that's what was so appealing to me about it. Because you know it's always sketchy when you have to rely upon a nation state, right, or a country. Because governments aren't very nice, as I'm sure your listeners are very well aware.
Yeah, and there's some interesting sort of success stories of people or of special economic zones that have done a lot better than others by somehow getting, you know, the government's permission to have lower taxes and have their own areas like Singapore and areas like that are better right. off. But anything that's really pushing toward liberty is probably going to be seen as a much greater danger than thank you for giving us less rules.
See,
right,
you know,
because
I mean, it could, but they could also use that as something like a tax haven or something, you know, and as long as it stays small and doesn't start competing for people moving there, doesn't start competing for people's attention in terms of business and investments and things like that. As long as it just remains a place where people can sink their money, the elites might be totally okay with that. So, you know, I think it all depends on how much the elites can use it as to whether or not they'll allow it to exist. But that's me, and I'm a cynical pessimist. So,
well, I agree with you to a certain point. I'd like to bring up Erwin Strauss here, who back in the mid 20th century was kind of the authority, and I mean that just kind of like he was the expert on these various new libertarian, you know, country projects. And he wrote a really good book, How to Start Your Own Country. And I would recommend if any of your listeners are interested in seasteading or, you know, I guess libertarian country building, that is a terrific book to start with. At the end of the book, he has about 150 case studies that he looks into as to, you know, various projects. I didn't know there were that many of them.
Yeah, that's
awesome.
But
Erwin Strauss says something really interesting, and I tend to agree with him that established countries and nation states, the great powers as he calls them, they want to keep the number of countries down because, you know, that continues the status quo. So I think any attempt at founding new libertarian countries, regardless of the intention, regardless of the size and scale, Nation states and countries don't like that because they have control as it is. They don't want to, other variables added to the equation. So I think that was a really interesting thing that he brought up. Because nations, obviously nation states hate competition. They hate the free market, right? So so I guess it kind of makes sense in that realm, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, the 150 case studies is pretty fascinating. Just that number is a...
Well, and let me just add a caveat there. They aren't all, new libertarian country projects.
Yeah, I understand.
But, there's a lot of different variety, but they're like, this is something that's not new. It's more kind of there's a relatively big micronation movement back in the 20th century. So smaller new nations. So it's just a really interesting realm of investigation, which has kind of been my focus for the past year. And it's really awesome to see some of these projects, even though I don't think they're really going to pan out the way the people who are running the project think it's going to. But regardless, I like to see the shift away from political crusading. Into even strategies that are probably not going to work. I'm glad to see that shift into direct action.
Yeah, it certainly helps get the creative juices flowing and people thinking in a different direction and thinking about various ways that they might help act in that to create liberty more quickly without relying on the state. Yeah, like you're saying, I've heard a few interviews of people with CSET studying and stuff. I haven't read a book on it yet or looked into it that much, but they don't seem to have a very definitive profit plan, which I think will end up being quite problematic. It doesn't seem like something that at this point is a really good investment. So then raising the capital necessary in order to... Seastead at such a large scale is going to be very difficult, and it's relying on donations in even with some profit, but using a lot of donation money just is not going to do it.
Yeah, these projects cost a lot of money, guys. cost a lot of money.
Well, you're living on the ocean. Of course it costs a lot of money. It's right. That's a pretty insane thing to try to figure out how to do, especially at a significant scale.
Yeah, and I guess 2 points real quick, and again, this is one reason I like the Marinilla Project, so much is that in the Quetzal Bank, that's a very highly traveled area, so Marinilla could act as a port, you could say, where there would be a lot of trade going through the area, so that's automatically right there, a profit, availability for profit. And then also too, there was talk of, it would be really easy to fish farm there. Harvest, I think it was like harvest seaweed, cause there are a lot of people that, use seaweed for nutritional, purposes now. Yeah. There are quite a few out there in the Quetzal Bank, quite a few profit potentials. The funding is always the hard part. It really is. It's, the CSETing Institute's running into that to a certain extent. And this is where kind of the unique case study comes in. I'm sure you guys heard of you've heard of Roger Ver from Bitcoin.com, so-called Bitcoin Jesus. He's planning on doing a new country project too. He's not calling it a country, but he is trying to do that. He wants to actually purchase land outright from an established government.
Nice.
And what's different about their project is he already has, a lot of people are made millionaires by cryptocurrency. So him and the Free Society Foundation already have $100 million.
Yeah,
to go into that project.
That's a great place to start for sure.
Right. So I saw that, and I'm, Erwin Strauss talked about, why would a government, not just. It's kind of like the non-libertarian drug dealer. If he can get the money and the drugs, why wouldn't he do that? So with a nation state, especially if there's not going to be any defense, why wouldn't the established country, just as soon as the check clears, so to speak, why wouldn't they just, take the money and the land? Because there's only so much land on Earth, and governments to just sell it outright is not very likely. Rather, what will probably happen in negotiations is they'll get like a 99-year lease or something, because then the nation state can obtain sovereignty, but still, make money off of, that venture. So I've got some concerns there, but immediately the funding, they've already got $100 million. And that's without any, private donations, from just the public. So they're a step ahead, but some concerns for sure.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, in terms of these sorts of projects, you need an anti-Somalia, I think. You need an example of what happens if anarchy thrives. You need an example of what happens when you have less or no government and it does extremely well compared to governed states. So, like, when people say, well, why don't you move to Somalia? Well, I'd rather go build a house in the Marinilla Project. Thank you very much.
Right. Yep. That's true. And that's one thing I've always kind of touted, or I guess said, that it would be a great benefit for, you know, libertarians and anarchists if one of these, I guess, free areas, maybe coercion free zones, at least to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And when they come into fruition, like if it's Marinilla, if it's if it's something else, if it's the Free Society Foundation's version, whatever, I don't care what it is. The point is that they can be a very good demonstration of laissez-faire and how effective it is when this so-called new country is thriving and quickly becoming one of the most profitable. And the statists, the communists and the socialists have to kind of take a second look and say, huh. Okay, maybe we're wrong about all this. Firsthand real world experience, I think, is really, really good. And that's something that's Rayo, who was a freedom pioneer in the 1960s, that's something he said in his book when he proposed kind of the sovereign freeport sort of scenario. He said that, you know, this is a great demonstration of laissez-faire if it can come to fruition.
Yeah, absolutely. Be interesting to see how many, or if any, big companies or what various banks might pop up in an area like a non-nation of Roger Ver. Just to see what a tax-free zone would look like and what the import-export deals would look like with various nation states. The concerns you brought up, or that we all, I think, have about the seasteading and buying a piece of land, all have to do with the fact that states exist. It's interesting. It highlights the importance still of changing hearts and minds, and
reaching out because you
need more people to oppose aggression, even state aggression, so that these things are much less problematic. And once you get to a sort of critical mass of individuals, a few hundred million, perhaps, or probably less, I think you'll be able to form these places of freedom and secure them more assuredly, even against nation states.
Yeah, and that's funny too, and it kind of just shows another contradiction within the minds of statists, is that you just kind of mentioned it, mentioned a few moments ago that, oh, if you don't like it in America, then leave. It's like, I'm trying, dang it, you won't let me.
Yeah. Yeah, the contradictions with status never end. There's a bunch of contradictions within myself that are still there, probably hanging about in my head that I haven't realized yet.
And just to clarify, it's not just communists and socialists that have a lot to learn. The right, and especially the GOP, the Tea Party kind of thing, have a lot to learn too, which their wet dream of a country, which is the USA, that was basically a bait and switch to a different ruler. So, it's all the same shit, different day, you know?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, the fascists too, sure. Toss them in there as well. Without mercantilist trade policies, everyone will be poor. Certainly a sovereign free port sort of thing could prove the complete wrongness of such an idea.
Yeah. And also, of course, the idea that you can start a government and have it respect the rights to property, because, Whiskey Rebellion, Civil War, Lysander Spooner's Postal Service that got shut down, all of these little, really easy, huge examples to point to of the government not giving a fuck about human rights, even if it's the, God blessed U.S. government, which we should all be praying to.
And worshiping that, at football games.
Yeah, or in the voting booth by please, please give me a different life. The Smallville theme plays in the background. I'm very cynical about how different the parties are. You know, a communist has their particular little snowflake bullshit to vent, and you know, a Republican does too. Like Ron Paul even said it recently. He said the snowflake moniker is often used to refer to people who are easily offended by just about everything. Unable to accept or acknowledge free will, these snowflakes attempt to use bully tactics and even government legislation to try to force people to think and act in a certain way. It's more of an annoyance than anything else. Free will still reigns supreme. No amount of legislation can change that. We're still naturally free to form our own opinions and act on them. While the snowflake designation has usually been reserved for people on the left side of the political spectrum, we may be seeing the emergence of snowflakes on the right as well. Apparently, many people on the right are offended by athletes or anyone else not standing up in front of the American flag while the national anthem is playing. Unable to acknowledge free will, they attempt to use bully tactics to try and force people to act a certain way. And so, you know, I mean, and it's not just that, it's always pretty much been that, you know, stomp my flag, I'll stomp your ass, that sort of bullshit, you know, like, so it's not just the left that needs a hard fought lesson in why the fuck you shouldn't like beg for coddling, because if it's not a communist or socialist government, it's going to be a GOP government that will violate somebody else's rights. And as long as your rights aren't being violated right now, that's the only thing that matters to the GOP, to the neocons, to the Tea Party, to the left, social justice warriors, Alinskyites, fucking
keep going. You know, don't stop now.
I just, you know, all those people are basically the same. They just want different rights violated than the other groups, so they have to ease them up a little bit every time they incrementally fuck us over.
Yeah, and the anarchist is, well, how about we just don't violate anyone's rights? Isn't right. that better? This is
but
all
guys, you
garbage.
Have to in order to live in a civilized society.
Yes,
right?
In order to live in a civilized society, we have to be barbaric toward one another through the state. Perfectly mm-hmm. reasonable. All right,
somebody has to do it.
I'm gonna bring us to survival and prepping very quickly, since that was
because
one of the main topics
we
were going to talk
society
about.
Society really is going to die, so I mean that's what we should be preparing for.
The state will die. At least I'm hopeful that many elements of society will remain. Shane, I have like a bag of peanuts in my cabinet. Am I fucked? That's the extent of my prepping.
So your food storage situation is just a bag of peanuts? Well, you're going to be good on protein.
Mostly a bag of peanuts. Yeah. I also have a bunch of meat that will go bad in a few days.
Well, you'd inevitably be very, very reliant upon grocery stores, and as with
I have two cats, so you know, okay, in an emergency, a couple meals.
Cat burgers. Yeah. My grandpa told me stories when he was in World War II. He told me stories about how they ate cat burgers. So yeah, I guess you could do that, I suppose.
Yeah.
But you'd be very reliant upon grocery stores, as with the rest of the survival society, and I think you'd run into some problems very quickly. If that's the situation that you find yourself in, just make sure you have a means of self-defense, because you've seen people on Black Friday just doing crazy stuff over just for a TV. Just imagine if there's actually a real situation, because that wouldn't be my actual recommendation. My actual recommendation would be, food storage doesn't have to be expensive, it doesn't have to be difficult, and there are a lot of models out there that you kind of go off of today. So
Vanu, right?
Vanu. Well, actually, Vanu's interesting. These folks actually kind of pioneered survivalism back in the 60s. Survivalism
well,
is definitely one.
I think first
of
humans kind of pioneered survivalism. These dudes might have picked up on it a little bit.
Fair enough, but survivalism as we kind of know it today with this massive market that's kind of grown out of like the food storage, Patriot Supply, E-Foods Direct, places like that, that wasn't available back in the 60s. So Rayo and other wilderness Fenuans had to be very creative with their food storage situation. But luckily today with technology advanced to the way it is, we don't have to kind of live in that primitive kind of state.
Yeah, absolutely. So give us, we're trying to wrap it up in like 10 minutes. I try to keep this solid because I got things to do. But can you give us like three simple things that you think are the most important things to do for prepping? Or do you have something like that? A few really practical sort of easy things, or as easy as they can be to be helpful?
Well, simple.
Right. Yeah. Right. I would recommend having, you know, kind of at least a 2 week supply, 2 week supply of food. If you can, hopefully you can fit it in a bug out bag. It depends upon how big your backpack is and how strong you are and how much you can carry in that backpack. But certainly some sort of a bug out bag, with 2 week supply of food. Typically I think most of the kits are, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days, which I don't think that's long enough by any means. As soon as you do get in a situation where you might need them, where you might need it, you'll often immediately, within just a couple of days, start worrying about how you're going to get your next meal. So 2 weeks can give you a little more peace of mind, and I guess in figuring out what you're going to do next. So obviously a bug out bag with some food storage in the bug out bag. Obviously, you know, some sort of a if you don't want to, you know, construct a shelter with native materials, if you're going to be bugging out in the woods, then you know, some sort of a really small tent would certainly be good. Beyond that, I mean, just I would say, you know, kind of rope can come in handy in a lot of situations.
Cordage.
Yeah, I always say rope. Yeah, cordage. So those would be a couple of things. Jeremy and I talked about last time we chatted about kind of like something like the life straw, to some sort of something to purify and clean your water.
Yeah.
Because water's important too. Important too. But
I'll write that down.
Yeah. If you weren't aware, guys, water is water's kind of important.
Water's good. Okay.
But I guess when Jeremy and I were talking last time, if you're going to be bugging out and you kind of already have those plans in place, I would go ahead and just choose a bug out location, if at all possible, that already has a good water supply, like a spring or a well or something like that. Because if you don't have to worry about water, that's pretty incredible, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Jeremy lives in the desert, so he's kind of screwed.
I have to go on a trek to where there is civilization in form of, you know, like rudimentary societies before I can do anything. That means that reasonably, I probably should make a lot of solar stills and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Got to adapt to your environment. Yeah. Oh, and I
or
guess
just drive really far.
that too. And I guess
I sort of don't want to be unethical even in a survival situation, and I don't own a car right now, so I would have to steal one, and I don't think I want to do that. I think I want to be one of the people that isn't like becoming a madman just because there's no government. I kind of want to prove the statists wrong.
Yeah, I agree.
Fair enough.
Maybe I don't know. I'm kind of thinking about prepping, and I'm thinking I might just try to gain a lot of fat. Do you think that is a helpful alternative to a 2 week supply of food?
Well, that is something that Rayo talked about. Be skeptical about people who say that they've gone and lived 2 weeks out in the wilderness. They didn't, because and he called it the slob society, because folks in the slob society have a lot of fat, and that's probably what they're living off of. So for a couple of weeks, probably that might certainly might help you. But once that fat starts to get eaten off, you better figure out a different alternative.
Well, and also eat lots of high fat foods in general, because your body will metabolize that quickly and it'll turn into energy more quickly. Basically go out in the wilderness and have the wilderness equivalent to the bulletproof lifestyle with lots of brain octane oils.
Sure. That sounds feasible. Yeah.
All right. Last question, just because I'm curious what your answer is. What do you think the most likely scenario is to make survivalism and prepping become necessary for the average American citizen?
So you saw, you're saying, like, what situation or scenario would come about that would make, you know, make prepping or survivalism necessary?
Yeah, yeah. That where I'd have to use the bug out bag. What do you think is the most likely cause of that?
The most likely cause. A lot of people have been fearful of nuclear wars. I'm not too concerned about something like that. That would eliminate a lot of tax tax slaves, and the state kind of needs those. Yep. I'd say probably.
Well,
I mean,
that is if you're not talking about the elites that like respect the Georgia Guidestones and want to see a breakaway civilization of, you know, elitists living underground while the fallout settles from the population culling down to 500,000.
Yeah, fair enough. So I'm not too worried about that one. I would say probably the most realistic one is something we've seen so much of in the past month: natural disasters. Especially with hurricanes, that would make it very. I mean, yeah, they're finding out firsthand that, especially in Puerto Rico, that they're relying upon food being imported into the country, food and water, and all the supplies that they need. With food specifically, or just prepping and survivalism, they're in a world of hurt. And if they would have, there's really no good outcome to a situation like that. But if you have your basic necessities at hand. It'll make things a lot easier, and you won't be completely dependent upon, the state to make sure that you survive. So I would say natural disasters are easily the situation where prepping and survivalism becomes very practical, and the demonization of survivalism and survivalists and preppers really.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and for those who prepped in those situations, yeah, they were smart. Quit talking crap about them.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the demonization of prepping is not because they don't think that stuff might happen. It's because they want to make anybody who seems to be prepping for extremes seem ridiculous so that they can push the status quo as something that's feasible and also desirable. If they can get people to stay on the same page instead of like moving to one or the other extreme in terms of survivalism, in terms of like preparing for the worst to come to worst, then they can make it seem as though the worst will never come to worst, no matter what anybody tells you. And that's the sort of propaganda that keeps people asleep and pacified. So fuck those people.
Even outside of the propaganda, I don't have evidence for this, but I think there's some truth to it. I think a lot of people choose to shame sort of survivalists and preppers, or talk about how ridiculous it is, because it helps them deal with their own insecurity of being so underprepared, and they makes them feel more safe if they, along with everyone else, can talk about how ridiculous these people are who will be okay if something insane happens, and they can just, it helps them assume that this probably won't happen at all, so I don't need to be worried about it.
Right, yeah, and that comes with any lifestyle that's not typical. So whether that is survivalism and prepping, or whether it's van nomadism or minimal sailboating or whatever it is,
or
those
even
lifestyles
like learning
are,
things like that, like guns, how to make rudimentary devices of certain sorts, martial arts, any sort of thing like that, where you're preparing for a society that they don't think exists anymore.
Yeah, and with all those things, you're taking personal responsibility, and that's something that the state of servile society, mainstream society, lacks to a large degree. So
yeah.
So there's a lot of projecting there, and a lot of and a lot of a harshness and vitriol just because people are taking initiative themselves for whatever purpose. And I think that's
exactly.
More demonstrative of the mainstream society than it is of any individual survivalist or prepper, anybody like that.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely agree. It's amazing how big of an aversion people have to even a 30 minutes of buying prepping stuff on Amazon that'll last you 25 years and cost
well,
you.
Well, the real amazing thing is people's aversion to reality.
Yeah. All right, we got to get out of here. I have to get out of here. My wife gives me a very a limited hour. So, Shane, do you want to plug your stuff?
Yeah, sure. So the main podcast I do, I've been doing it for a couple of years now, Liberty Under Attack. There we talk about, but it's typically based around direct action, you know, taking the initiative yourself and finding your own freedom without begging those who falsely imagine themselves to be our rulers.
Nice.
That would be Liberty Under Attack. Yeah, mostly direct action, some philosophy in there, some economics, that sort of good stuff. The second podcast I do, which I started in January of this year, the Vanu podcast. I mentioned Vanu and Rayo a couple of times in this discussion.
Yeah.
And that podcast is devoted to those ideas. So just real briefly, VANU is simply an awkward contraction of voluntary and not vulnerable. It's premised around becoming as invulnerable to coercion as you possibly can, and that's both from public coercers, the state, and private coercers, criminals. So that's the basic premise, and the strategies that Rayo lays out are derived from that basic principle. So that would be VANUpodcast.com. If you're interested in the survivalism stuff, I mean, definitely check out the episode we did on food storage. It's very long, but we went into a lot of depth on the subject. And the last one I did until a couple weeks ago, the Marinilla podcast. If you're interested in learning more about that, or if any of your listeners have a lot of money and they want to help bring it into fruition, I mean, it's on hold, but everything's still in place. If something like that does come about, marinilla.org, you can find the podcast there, the business plan, et cetera. So that would be kind of the all the work that I do.
Sweet. Well, thanks a lot for joining us,
and,
Shane.
And just leave a link to anything you want us to do in the chat, by the way.
Okay. Yeah, for show notes. Yeah, I can do that. Not a problem. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Harding, anything you want to say?
Obviously, if you want to join the Third Reich of Anarchy, you can do that. I started an anarchist group on furryspeech.com. it's the biggest joke.
The powerful furry community.
Yeah.
Must be reached.
Then you can head over there. Also, I'm about to join a live stream with Porpoiseful Discussion. Other than that, you can check me out on on IPMNation.com and JournalisticRevolution.com, Moment of Rage, and you can also follow me at Insanity is Free pretty much fucking everywhere, because that's a fairly polarizing username and I'm the only one with it. Smash the state, fight the motherfuckers.
Yeah, sounds good. All right, y'all. Don't follow me anywhere or pay attention to anything I do. Thanks for joining us today. Have a good one. Love your neighbor. Hate the state. Peace.